From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
A Minnesota police officer is arrested in the death of George Floyd. President Trump signs an executive order on social media, and a Democratic pollster explains who should be Joe Biden's vice president. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jagot. We are joined today by my colleagues, Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
And Dan Henninger. Hi, Dan.
Unmuted, here I am.
On Friday, the authorities in Minneapolis took into custody a police officer there, Derek Chauvin, who was shown in video with his knee pinned on the neck of George Floyd, a black man who was being arrested on Memorial Day. There are now reports that Chauvin is being charged with third-degree murder, and this is a fast-moving situation, obviously, Bill, but what do we know so far?
Well, I know very little apart from what I've seen in the tape, which looks awful because the man is pleading for air and so forth, and the knee is firmly in his neck. But we don't know what preceded this. We don't know what's after. I'm very leery of quick moves like this to indict. If you remember, Mayor Fry, who failed to protect his city, called for the officer to be criminally charged right at the beginning without having any facts. So, I mean, there's a reason we have due process. It looks very bad. If the evidence after the investigation shows he deserves prosecution, I'd be all for it. But I do worry that due process can get overrun, because we've seen in so many other cases before that once the full evidence is in, the picture can look a little different.
Yeah, and that's all that is true. The video, though, is very harrowing. I mean, taken by a bystander with Floyd handcuffed on his stomach on the ground, saying he can't breathe, the officer's knee on his neck. And Dan, I mean, the obvious question, the question that everyone here is asking is what could prompt using that level of force?
Former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick has said that the technique and the practice evident there was atrocious, in his word, and it sounds like it might be. With what all is going on, it's pretty clear that the local prosecutors from the local level on up to the Department of Justice in Washington are now fully engaged to see whether excessive force was used, and indeed whether Officer Chauvin violated Mr. Floyd's civil rights under federal law. So the process of prosecution is underway. It is going to be examined at great length. I was reading a piece earlier today by a former Department of Justice official who worked for the Corporation Counsel's Office in Boston prosecuting cases like this. He said they do have to look for probable cause. It's usually a time-consuming process, but that's going to happen here. The tragedy is what happened afterwards, and the burning and looting of that neighborhood in Minneapolis. That's something the people there are going to have to live with for the rest of their lives, and that's really quite sad.
Yeah, the statement that you mentioned from the New York Police Authority is interesting. There have been a number of those, and that's notable to me. I mean, there have been reports that other departments don't allow that kind of hold, that kind of tactic, or have moved away from it. And one of the things that makes this so interesting is that the game changer of cameras in these scenarios, Bill, it seems to me. I mean, in the old days, you might have some incident like this and it would be filed in a police report and nobody would ever hear about it. And now, I mean, the police here were reportedly wearing body cameras and also the cell phone cameras, obviously, with the bystanders. I mean, that's ubiquitous. It makes it much more likely that the public, the authorities, prosecutors, police can get to the bottom of tragic situations like this.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it works both ways. In New York, we've had a couple of cases since the police were required to wear cameras where people made accusations against the police that were not supported by the tape. Again, this tape is very powerful and upsetting, and it looks like there's no excuse for the officer. But again, that's why we have due process and are not supposed to make decisions in the heat of emotion. So many of these cases have turned out very differently once people examine all the evidence. And I'm of the school of reserving judgment until I see more than just a video.
This has prompted protests in many places, but specifically in Minneapolis. Some of those have turned violent with businesses burned, an AutoZone, a Dollar Tree, whose the owners of those businesses have nothing to do with the officer or the police or the situation. There was a CNN crew that was arrested on live television. And Minneapolis is now reportedly going to be under curfew Friday with National Guard patrolling. And Dan, that it all seems pretty remarkable to me for this kind of thing to be happening in the middle of an American city.
Yes, it is. But it's happened before, Kyle. And this is a big issue. This is a big subject. An urban riot like this is a devastating event. There has been some research done on the urban riots of the 1960s that occurred in places like East Brooklyn, the Huff neighborhood of Cleveland, Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. And what these studies have suggested is these neighborhoods have a very hard time coming back for a lot of complicated reasons, but they just don't revive easily at all. You don't simply rebuild. Once neighborhoods get burned out, as happened to the AutoZone and the Target store there, they don't come back. Target said it's closing a lot of its stores in the state. And if you look at the neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Baltimore, Watts area of Los Angeles, they still are in pretty bad shape. And we're kind of living with the legacy of what went on 50 or 60 years ago when people today complain nothing has gotten better. Well, in some sense, they're right. But the reasons why they haven't gotten better is something that really, really needs some close analysis. We ought to talk about that now. How can you be living in a city in New York, Los Angeles, Baltimore, and 60 years later have your neighborhood still looking like it did back when it burned so many years ago?
And President Trump has waded in here on Twitter, of course, which he can't help from doing, and sided against the violent protests, of course, and it caused some controversy here. So one of the things he said was, here's a tweet from him, quote, "These thugs are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd, and I won't let that happen. Just spoke to Governor Tim Walz and told him that the military is with him all the way. Any difficulty and we will assume control. But when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Thank you," unquote. And this tweet has now been put behind a filter screen saying that it breaks the rules, glorifying violence. Bill, what do you make of Twitter's action there?
Well, first of all, I think that the president is absolutely right. He may be indelicate, but he's right. Does anyone believe that the people setting fire to buildings and looting a Target or anything but thugs? And this, what we saw in Minneapolis the last couple of nights, is the absolute failure of the public authorities to fulfill their basic responsibility to protect the citizens there. And the innocent are the ones that suffer from this. How is justice served by, again, setting fire to a Wendy's or coming out with stolen stuff from a Target or anything, throwing bottles at firefighters and police? This is ridiculous to make any excuses for that. And unfortunately, Stan suggests we've seen this as a reaction in a lot of other cases, and we shouldn't make any excuses for it. You know, it should be pretty simple. We ought to be able to say if the police did something wrong, including murder, manslaughter, whatever it is, they should be called to account for it. But that doesn't give people license to go around and damage property and create upheaval. We should be able to do both.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Neither side on the debate between Twitter and the president is backing down here. A couple days ago, Twitter put a fact check on two of President Trump's tweets, talking about the dangers, warning of the dangers of mail voting. And then this filter screen on his new tweet warning about glorifying violence. So Twitter not backing down there. And then the president, for his part, signing on Thursday an executive order on social media. So social media has a immunity from liability from what people tweet, people put on Facebook under a section of law called Section 230. And the president is now telling regulators to go figure out if they can define when Section 230 does not apply, when a platform like Twitter could lose its liability immunity here. Dan, do you think that's a reasonable argument for the president to make?
No, I don't think it's a particularly reasonable argument. I can see the president's concerns. I mean, he's been in a nonstop battle for nearly 4 years with every nook and cranny of the media, from the White House press corps to Twitter to CNN. It just never stops. And both sides, I think, overreact a lot of the time. But here, the president is suggesting that the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission should examine Twitter, Facebook, and the rest of them to see whether they are complying with Section 230. And my fear is that once these sorts of restrictions are put in place, made part of federal authority, make no mistake, once the administration turns over, if it should perhaps at the end of the year, and the Democrats come into power, I think they would most certainly use that authority to suppress and pressure conservative viewpoints across social media. For instance, saying a certain expressions, points of view are racist or bigoted or homophobic, the usual stuff that we hear people being banned from speaking on campuses for. So it's a two-edged sword, Kyle, and I think that the White House should think a little bit before making it permanent.
Well, the tech legal experts that I have read on this seem to think that the order does not really do all that much, because Section 230 is in a law passed by Congress, and it would be hard for the president on his own to take much of a bite out of it. But there is some appetite in Congress to do so. Senator Josh Hawley has introduced a bill. He introduced a bill last year that would require big tech platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, to get a certificate every 2 years from the Federal Trade Commission, certifying that they are unbiased. They don't moderate based on political viewpoint. But I mean, in my mind, I guess this is built on a misunderstanding that Section 230 requires some sort of neutrality, which is impossible in reality to reach. So, I mean, Facebook, for instance, Instagram, let's start with Instagram. Instagram bans nudity, which is constitutionally protected speech. And no one is suggesting that Instagram has to let nudity on its platform. Facebook bans all sorts of stuff. They delete all sorts of stuff all the time, every day. And if you want to get on Facebook and organize, you know, a rally for white supremacy, you're going to find yourself deleted really fast. And what I am struggling to understand, Bill, is the argument for neutrality that that excludes white supremacists and includes everything we like. It seems like an impossible standard that they're aiming at.
Yeah, well, they don't include everything I like, but you're right. Look, there's a tension between how we treat social media. It's considered a platform, right? Like a public square. So the owners aren't really liable the way they would if they were the owners of the Wall Street Journal for what appears on there. Nonetheless, the courts have upheld that they have the right to make some distinctions and get rid of some behavior that they think is inappropriate. That's a tough line to draw, and I think the courts are still working on that. In these cases, I think I don't think it's anywhere close to that. This is political speech, and under the guise of fact checking, people are suppressing information that they don't like. I don't like what they're doing. I'm skeptical of any kind of fairness doctrine approach. Dan was talking about this before. Remember, it was just a few years ago that liberals wanted some kind of fairness doctrine revived because they were worried that Rush Limbaugh and conservative hosts were dominating talk radio. So it is a double-edged sword, and I just don't think we need it.
But I guess the argument I'm trying to make is that they're not public forums. I mean, Twitter is not the park in Skokie, Illinois. Twitter is a private company, and it exists to make money for its shareholders, for its owners, and they have the right to decide what goes on their servers. And I just don't see the argument for forcing Twitter and Facebook to disseminate information that they disagree with, Dan.
Well, yeah, I think there's one larger issue here, which is that Section 230 was part of the so-called Decency Act of 1996. And pretty clearly, the Decency Act, which was supposed to prevent this sort of thing, hasn't worked. You were describing Facebook and the other social media platforms blocking thousands upon thousands of entries a day for because they're pornography, they're too violent, they're terrorist. I mean, social media is basically a swamp and a cesspool. And I think that the nature of these platforms pretty much demolished personal guardrails for a lot of people. And this is a society-wide problem. The society needs to reform itself, and I'd say good luck with that. But it's a tide that you're trying to hold back with rules like this. And I think the tidal forces are probably just stronger than any rules that Donald Trump or anybody else can make.
A bit of more news on Friday. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who ran for president and has been vying potentially to be Joe Biden's vice president. There's now criticism her related to this Minnesota incident, Bill, where people are saying that this officer had previous complaints against him and that Klobuchar, who was the prosecutor there at the time, didn't go after him. Does that seem like a fair criticism to you, Bill?
No, it doesn't seem like a fair criticism, but is absolutely to be expected when you go down the road of identity politics. I don't know that previous case with Amy Klobuchar. Was there evidence? What was the accusation? We have no idea what went into her decision, and merely because she's involved in that and this effort to run people through an identity politics purity test is very destructive. And I think Joe Biden's going through the same thing, not because of Minneapolis, but Joe Biden did very well among African Americans. And now they're treating him as though he doesn't go far enough, demanding, you know, that he promised to appoint more people by race. He's already promised to appoint an African American to the Supreme Court and to choose a woman as a running mate. So I think Amy Klobuchar is in the same category. She's paying the same price because I think what we're learning from this, enough is never enough when you go down that road.
Klobuchar has taken some time on Friday to argue against this idea. So here's a quote from her. She says, this idea that I somehow declined a case which has been reported on some news blogs and then sent out on the internet against this officer is absolutely false. It is a lie. I don't know what else to say about it than it is a lie, unquote. But fair or not, Dan, I mean, do you think this makes it more difficult for Biden to pick her as a potential VP if that's what he was intending to do?
I think Amy Klobuchar is finished. She's done. This it's over for her. This is the Democratic Party, as Bill was just describing it. And the mere suspicion and accusation that Klobuchar failed to prosecute this particular guy who's involved in this incident means she's out of it. She's gone. And I think it also ensures the fact that the Democrats are going to want the vice presidential pick, a woman, to be a black woman. It means that some of the Hispanics that were mentioned, like Senator Catherine Cortez Mastro, are not going to be picked. She took herself out of the running yesterday. So it's now down to Kamala Harris, Representative Val Demings of Florida, Stacey Abrams of Georgia, maybe Representative Marsha Fudge of Ohio. That's just the reality now for the Democrats. And be that as it may, the progressives, they are on board for racial justice and making a statement about that. But some of the other progressives have economic policies in mind that they want to push, such as Medicare for all and environmental issues. So I don't think the dispute is over, but I think Amy Klobuchar is gone.
Yeah, though that argument, Dan, goes against some of the advice, the other advice that Biden is getting. So there's a report in Politico that Stan Greenberg, a pollster for Democratic candidates, is urging Biden to pick Elizabeth Warren. And there's been this split within the party where Biden has been trying to, working very hard to get Bernie Sanders supporters over to his side. And Greenberg, Bill, says that Warren is the one who can do it. Warren is the one who can unite the party and is showing the best, brings the most to the Biden ticket. I mean, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I think that that argument's sound if you think that Joe Biden's only option is to really move left and appease the Bernie voters. He's been trying to do that for months, and he's been throwing overboard a lot of things that led people to vote for him in the first place, you know, under the on the grounds that he was more moderate. I think it's a big mistake that he's effectively letting Senator Sanders veto his platform and his choices. And I think that's a big mistake. He's won. I think he's going to need to reach out to traditional parts of the Democratic Party that are not as progressive as Senator Sanders. Remember, Senator Sanders didn't win, and yet he seems to be winning the post-primary in terms of getting the man who had the most votes to bend to his direction.
Well, that would be an interesting turn if he went back towards the center. I mean, I think a lot of people expected that once he had locked up the nomination, Dan, but he has spent weeks even after that adopting policies from Warren, adopting policies from Sanders, talking about just wiping out a certain amount of people's student loans. So far as I can see, he's given no indication that he's going to go back towards the center. I mean, he thinks he needs those Warren Sanders voters, that wing of the party, to win.
Yeah. Well, I love the idea of him picking Elizabeth Warren for his VP. That would probably cause as many Americans to vote against him and for Trump as it would bring progressives over voting for Joe Biden. I mean, she is such a divisive figure. She was sort of past her expiration date at the end of the primaries, people could not bear to listen to her anymore. But between listening to Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren for 4 or 5 months or 3 months before the election, I mean, there's some aesthetic value to a vice presidential pick. And I'm not sure in terms of having to listen to her, Elizabeth Warren quite qualifies.
All right. Thank you, Bill and Dan. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.